So I should thank Stan for reading this psalm. He is indeed the troublemaker who chose this psalm. But I'm glad he did. I do hope that this summer of services centered around psalms has sparked some interest in your reading the psalms. Just to open the Bible right in the middle and start reading. I encourage you just to try it every day. Read a psalm or two. And you'll find every kind of human emotion you can think of in these psalms. Next Sunday is one that is perhaps more positive. Next Sunday will be Psalm 121, which you know as "I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills, from whence cometh my help. My help cometh from the Lord who made heaven and earth." But today, we have Psalm 137. Will Campbell, who many of you recognize as a writer and an activist, until his death last year, wrote in a little log cabin behind his house in Mount Juliet, Tennessee. And on the wall of that cabin near his desk was a sign that read, "Thank you for not cussing." C-U-S-S-I-N, apostrophe. "Thank you for not cussing." We could never put a sign on the Bible that says, "Thank you for not cussing." Because the truth is, the Bible is full of cussing. Now, don't mistake real cussing with mere slang or scatological language. I'm talking about real cursing. Real cursings. They are an important part of the Bible. So I'm sure this needs further explanation. Cursing is the flip side of blessing. And both of them are rooted in religion. If I were to use the oldest blessing in the Bible at the end of a worship service, I would start out by saying, "The Lord bless you and keep you." Now, the flip side of that blessing would be, "The Lord curse you and abandon you." One is a benediction, the other is a malediction. The Bible has both. Now we go a step further. My Bible may be considered a divine book for sure, but it is also a human book. A human book filled with every human emotion we can think of. And what more human emotion could there be than rage associated with tragedy? That rage is expressed in the Bible in the form of curses, often centered around one of the great defining moments in Jewish history, namely the fall of Jerusalem in the 6th century before Christ. It was a bloody, bitter, cruel military devastation of their beloved city. There is, in fact, an entire book in the Old Testament devoted to laments about the fall of Jerusalem. It is called the Book of Lamentations. That's what they're lamenting. We don't read it very often, but here's the way it starts out. "How lonely sits the city that once was full of people. How like a widow she has become, she that was great among the nations. She that was a princess among the provinces has become a vassal. It was a shattering of their faith. It raised all kinds of questions about God and their perceived place as what they believed was a chosen people. It literally shook them to the core. And they would spend centuries trying to sort it all out. What could all this mean? How could God allow our city to be overrun and destroyed? And in the midst of their grief and bitterness over such a defeat, we have a body of literature in the Bible which can only be described as cursings. Many of the Psalms are classified as cursing Psalms. They lament the fall of Jerusalem and they call for vengeance on those who perpetrated such cruelty. Psalm 137 is perhaps the most familiar of those cursing Psalms. Its opening lines are sublime in their beauty. It's heartbreaking. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and there we wept when we remembered Zion. The psalm goes on to describe the bitterness when their captors begged them to sing for us one of the songs of Zion. It was turning their grief into a minstrel show. It was turning something holy into entertainment for their captors. They couldn't do it. So they hung their harps up on the tree limbs. And by the end of the psalm, the bitter rage rises to the surface. The author's anger is first directed not toward Babylon, but toward the land of Edom. Remember, O Lord, against the Edomites, the day of Jerusalem's fall, how they said, tear it down, down to its foundations. Edom was a neighbor. There was intermarriage with Edomites. They were located just south of Jerusalem. And the people of Edom sided with Babylon to destroy the city of Jerusalem. This sense of betrayal that the Israelites felt lasted for hundreds of years. They were betrayed by their nearest neighbor. Then the writer's seething hatred and resentment toward Babylon erupts. At the very end of the psalm, his fury is so great that he creates a backhanded curse in the form of a blessing on those who would wreak vengeance on Babylon by brutally killing their children, presumably the same way the Israelite children had been killed when Babylon destroyed the city. O daughter Babylon, you devastator, happy shall they be who pay you back for what you have done to us. Happy shall they be who take your little ones and dash them against the rock. So ends the curse, and so ends the psalm. It may still be shocking that something like this is actually in the Bible. But remember, there is no sign on the Bible that says, thank you for not cussing. Now let's think together about the meaning of this. It is no accident that we begin every worship service with a hymn of praise. Why do we do that? Don't we all recognize that there are some times when we enter the worship space with anything but praise on our heart, in our hearts? Don't we know that sometimes we enter this place with our own version of Psalm 137, you may come into the sanctuary today thinking, by the rivers of worry, there I sat down and there I wept. By the rivers of misunderstanding and estrangement, there I sat down and there I wept. We all have our own version. Someone else might say, by the rivers of loneliness or anxiety or credit card bills or red ink, there I sat down and there I wept. You see where I'm headed here? We all enter this sanctuary from time to time with anything but praise in our hearts. Yet we always begin with praise. Why? The answer is simple. Sometimes we sing praise to God not because of, but in spite of. That is the beginning of an adequate faith. It is the praise of God in spite of what we're facing in our lives. Now, you may have recognized some familiarity with the title of this sermon. It's a play on the title of the old Paul Simon song entitled Still Crazy After All These Years. In that song, he sang about picking up a thread of a relationship that had once been strong, and then time and distance had separated them. But one evening he runs into his old flame on the street corner, and they share a beer together, talk of old times, and then they part ways again. Then he concludes, still crazy after all these years. Still crazy after all these years. And we're left to wonder exactly what he meant. Was she still crazy after all these years? Or was it him who was still crazy after all these years? Or was it his feelings that were still crazy and mixed up after running into his old flame after all these years? We don't know. We're left. But in this sermon, I'm talking about faithfulness. Faithfulness to God, faithfulness to the church, still faithful after all these years. I'm talking about an adequate faith that is still there even when we sit down by the rivers of time and weep. Even when our anger and our rage rises to the surface like the writer of this psalm, and we strike out at life or even those around us, I'm talking about faith when we feel like cussing. To read a psalm like this is to be reminded that real faithfulness has no illusions about life. It is unshockable. We're not thrown off balance by some respected minister who runs off with his secretary. Our faith is not shattered because some priest abuses children. Sad, outraged, yes. But our faith is not shattered. Mature faith is not shocked because goodness is not always rewarded the way we think it should be. Our faith does not stumble over leukemia attacking a child. Our faith does not stumble over a drunk driver driving his car up onto the sidewalk and mowing down pedestrians. In short, our faith in God is not dependent on our escaping the inevitable disappointments and tragedies of life. An adequate faith is one that is not surprised by the potholes, like New England roads in the spring thaw. They're just part of the journey. Now we can go a step further and actually find inspiration in a psalm like this. An adequate faith is not afraid of expressing our disappointments and even anger within the context of a loving community of faith. Let's get out of our minds that church is all backslapping and hugs. As Dan Ivins would say, here we agree differently. A mature community of faith is willing to deal with both our feelings and our cursings as well as our blessings. Oh yeah, one more thing. An adequate faith knows that bad things really do happen to good people. Marriages fail among the finest of people. Germs pay no attention to church attendance. Broken promises are not just for the bad guys. But does that mean that God has left us? An adequate faith knows better. You know, when you're standing in a checkout line at a grocery store, it's not very common to hear people carry on a conversation in front of you. But here are two older women sharing a conversation. They obviously didn't know each other, but one of them was apparently admiring the beautiful gray hair of the other. And she said, I don't know you, but I've been admiring the color of your hair. I'd give anything in the world if I had hair as beautifully gray as yours. I know this is a personal question, but could you tell me what you put on it? And there was a pause. And the second woman said, honey, I don't put anything on my hair. It turned this color almost overnight. I had a child to die suddenly, and then my husband got sick and lingered, and then he died. Things were just hard then, and it just happened. My hair turned this color gray overnight. And then she said, honey, you can't get this out of a bottle. Now, there are some things you can't buy over the counter and you can't get out of a bottle. God comes to us in the hard places, the unfair places, the difficult places of our lives. Even if we feel alone, even when we find ourselves cussing the whole world. What if in today's worship, now, in these moments, you laid all your deep down resentment and anger over some past event, whatever it might be, just laid it before God? What if you heard the words of Jesus, come unto me, all you who labor and are heavy laden. You're laden down with this anger. And I will give you rest. Rest from the anger that is debilitating your life. Rest from resentment that is demeaning. And rest from those visions of revenge that seem delicious. If you could lay those burdens down in this moment, like rocks on a cairn, you would finally be free to move ahead in your life, you could once again take your harp down from the willows of time and sing the songs of Zion. In the ever contemporary words of the prophet Isaiah, you would this day go out in joy and be led back in peace.